This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive. Never know how much I care.
following program contains subject matter that portrays gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered people as first-class citizens, deserving of an equal share of the American dream. Topics like this are known to piss off televangelists, backwater preachers, some talk show hosts, blue-haired biddies, several members of Congress, and other socially unacceptable outcasts like radical right-wing nut jobs. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
You have tuned into After Hours Queer Radio with Attitude, a continuing tradition here on KPFT 90.1 FM. The crew of After Hours is ready to bring you news, interviews, discussions, and music geared to the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community and our allies. We are a diverse group here, but we all have one thing in common. We are out of the closet and urge everyone to come out of his or her closet as well. That means recognizing who you are, standing up for yourself and your rights, and being proud of who you are. We understand that this might not be possible due to age, job, or frame of mind, but remember, we are here especially for you. So kick back and relax and get ready for this week's edition of After Hours.
In Galveston in the world. This is After Hours Queer Radio with Attitude. My name is Chris Harrison. Unless you're contacting the FCC, then make up some other name.
And you are?
I just said I'm Chris Harrison.
What are you?
Co-executive producer,
yes,
yada, yada,
and
yada.
I'm Jimmy Carper. I'm the other one, remember?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I don't want to identify us too much, you know. I know people are actually listening out there.
Mm-hmm.
And they're mean. So, they're out to get me.
You're in a mood tonight.
Well, you know, when you schedule an event at a restaurant and you call up earlier in the week,
mm-hmm.
and the waitress, which I could hear all three of her teeth when she told me, on Saturday we're open till 9 p.m.,
mm-hmm.
and you get there and there's a big sign saying we're closed.
What time did you get there?
7. They're closed for repairs, so either, you know, their stove caught fire or they heard the fat men were coming to eat. Because, you know, while we're sitting in the parking lot, there were three couples, average age, Methuselah, stopping off to eat, wanting to eat, and they all look at the sign going, well, they're closed. Yeah, I thought it'd been hilarious.
That's where the big men's club is holding their Thanksgiving get-together?
Yeah, we were going to go to, hold on to your seat, the pig stand. I thought, insert your joke here. Big men's
club. I've been there and I've never seen any pigs standing around.
Well, that's because they were closed the night we went to go eat.
They were all at the ripcord, that's why.
And, you know, we get there and we're looking at the sign going, what are we going to do now?
So what did you do now?
Well, we went to Hickory Hollow and made fun of the singers.
Oh, okay. Singers?
Yeah, they have singers on Saturday night.
Oh, my God, no.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no.
Unfortunately, they were around the corner, so they didn't see us making fun of them. Mm. But, you know, jambalaya, crawfish pie, filet gumbo. Well, it's not on the menu here.
Oh, lordy.
Speaking of lordy, let's call up these people.
No, we're not even going there. There's a whole lot of stuff going on because this is the eve of Thanksgiving, and then we're off for Christmas and
all of those holidays.
Or how many weeks away till we start playing the Christmas carols?
Two.
2 weeks.
Yep, and I already have I've received some new stuff. I've got some stuff coming in, and I've got some people who've sent MP3s. You know how to put an MP3 on a CD?
No, that way I can play it on the computer.
Oh, really?
That's how we did soccer practice. That's how we play Sosei.
Oh.
So I guess for Hanukkah, we definitely have to play the Bar Mitzvah remix.
Yes, we do.
Is that anything like Hava Nagila?
No, it's work/play the Bar Mitzvah remix.
Okay.
You know, when you've got a gay, white, Jewish rapper out there, I figure you got to play him every week.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. You didn't just say that.
He said it.
There's another rapper that's come out that I saw something on the news there. He's a gay, white rapper. But he doesn't have the Jewish part.
Yeah.
No. Well,
and again, this is KPFT. Am I supposed to be playing Jewish stuff?
There's a lot of gay white rappers. I hate to tell you this.
Oh, yeah.
We've had one as a guest on this show.
Yeah, but what are they rapping?
Oh, it's gay. It's homo hop.
Homo hop.
This guy does glam hop.
Ooh.
So, you know,
speaking of music.
Please.
Don't ask me what the hell you played. I was in the other room smoking a banana cigar.
Okay. Well, the first one was Joshua Clip. And we played the third selection on his EP.
That nipple's an innie.
Turn it over.
I don't see anything more important on there. His naked chest is on the front, not on the back.
Well, the title of the song is on the back, the third selection.
Time We Don't Have to Waste.
Yes. And he's got a Christmas song on there.
December Snow.
That we'll be playing next month. And after him, we played an oldie but goodie. We played Horse.
And what you wrote in on.
Very first CD before she came out. It's called And She Smiled.
Oh, so back when she was just a whiny singer
Actually, when
guitar.
She first came out, the very nebulous pictures of her, and it was, is this a man or a woman? And nobody really knew.
And, of course, they assumed with a name like Horse.
Yeah.
They thought Stallion, not Mare.
So, it was. She came out of the closet, and all of a sudden, and she smiled, as the title of the song made sense.
And she came out as a gelding.
Yes. Well, stop. Okay, let's see.
Do you want me in the bitchy, sad mood that I've been in for a while?
Oh, God, I don't know.
Now, what put you in that bitchy, sad mood?
Unemployed, living in a hotel, getting ready to get kicked out of it.
Here we go again.
But now you're employed in Tomball.
Yee-haw! I missed the parade tonight.
There was a parade?
Yeah.
Tomball?
Yeah.
He went to the bathroom, so he missed the parade.
Oh, never mind.
Tomball's got two streets, Main and Plum.
Yes.
You get off Main, you're Plum out of town.
Well, that's like being at the corner of Plum and 40. Plum out in Sticks and 40 miles from nowhere.
Gotcha.
That's about it.
Okay.
I'm surprised we don't have a horse tie in front of the store.
Stop it.
A store. What store?
Yes. Things going on in the community. You have one more chance to see 2 one-hour documentaries at Rice Media Center. It will be held Sunday night at 7 p.m. The first of the two will be Ray Hill's Prison Show, nationally syndicated show heard weekly on KPFT at 9 p.m. on Friday nights. The documentary for The Prison Show was produced by Brian Huberson. The award-winning show is some prisoners' only direct connection with the outside world. The second documentary is A Life and Times of Colorful Catherine J. Charles McGuire, a former Marine who owned a construction company and hit the Houston social scene in the 80s, leaving Houston to somewhere in East Europe after some problems involving taxes. And after Charles McGuire transitioned to become Catherine McGuire. I've got a thing here from Ray that he will actually be there.
She will be there.
No, Ray Hill will be there.
Oh.
I ran into Ray at Kroger the other night.
Uh-uh.
I'm sorry.
Hmm.
I saw him briefly just this past week also. He's looking good.
Yes.
Saturday and Sunday. So that is at the Rice Media Center, 7 p.m. Sunday night. Sunday. And things going on with ICOH. Let's see. Cotillion is happening.
Oh, wait, let's have the Empress and Empress talk about it.
It's
hard to get them quiet.
This is a night with the Royals, and they're not here. But, so I'll be going over a few things. But next week, who have we got coming in for the After Hours Quickie?
Don't ask me.
It depends on who I talk to.
How about the Houston?
I thought you told me that...
You're the one who set that up. I didn't.
No, I didn't.
Falcon told me they were coming the next week. I was setting up for next month.
Oh.
Falcon is in Falcon Studios?
No, Falcon is in...
Chair Dude's other half.
Whose other half?
Chair Dude's worse half.
Ooh.
Chair Dude. Chair Dude?
You don't know Chair Dude.
I don't know Chair Dude.
Falcon is...
You've met Falcon, but see, Falcon's usually here with Steven, and Steven's usually, you know, smuggling those squirrels in his jeans, so you may not remember Falcon.
Yeah. Falcon is a member of the Colt 45s.
Uh-huh. And...
He's been here many times at the first... First of... Yeah.
He ought to give him a crown with an ampersand on there with so many...
In fact, Stephen is supposed to drop by here later this evening and drop off something for me.
He is?
Yes.
Not his jeans. It's something different.
No,
green and round.
Anyway, Cotillion is happening later on this afternoon.
I love the look of it.
5 p.m. on Sunday, November the 19th. Doors open at 5 p.m. at 1415 California. Cotillion is where the new emperor and empress...
announce their line.
And announce their line of secession, right.
And give the check from the old one and announce who the charity is for the next year.
That's exactly right.
I was paying attention on Wednesday.
You were. And then a small show afterwards. So that
with them, nothing is small.
Well, this is a big deal. It's one of the three state performances where all the members will be really dressed up.
Ouch.
Hey.
And a light buffet. And
yes.
Tables are available for $25, I believe.
Yes. Very good. Although there's no entry fee.
Yeah. You don't have it. If you want to sit down, you know, it's $25.
Yeah. For a table of four. And
like I said, I paid attention on
you one. Really did. You really did. Also, ICOH invites the community... to come to Mary's naturally on Wednesday, November the 22nd, as we celebrate five of our exalted members' day of birth. The honorees this month are Stephen Baker, Ed Moniger, Jerry DeWeese, Chris Wilkinson, and Jeannie Owens.
Jeannie.
Some birthday celebrations will begin at 7:30 with the old-fashioned jukebox show to follow at 9. A spaghetti dinner will be served and donations would be appreciated. And
all of this is being done at Mary's naturally.
A birthday cake will be provided by a bakery called 10 Inches to Go.
And a word of warning, if you go to Mary's and Rose offers you a shot...
Don't take it.
And then the next day, happy Thanksgiving, come one, come all, to Eartha's Old Fashioned. You got quaking in your boots because the food's a fill in your nostrils, clean up to your blue hair. Thanksgiving dinner for all. Come to pile the debris on your China Bonet Capri plates. Add some not as tough as Chris Baudier's leather turkey and eat yourself into a oblivion with all your community friends and neighbors.
Can't do that. I gotta work.
That's the title.
Bibbidi bobbidi boo.
It's honoring four members of ICOH who...
If it was any longer, we'd call it the Pride Parade.
...who have died this past year. Earthquake.
Wait a minute. I didn't know Eartha had passed.
Yes, Eartha passed.
Yes.
When?
About 2-3 months ago. Yes.
Thank you for playing. We have a lovely parting gift.
Tiny...
Yep.
Okay.
And Joel Eisenhower, also known as the Pilot Debris, Chanda Bonet Capri, and Chris Baudier, four of our members who have passed, and so we want to honor them and name this. Our Majesty Gingivitis will be hosting Thanksgiving dinner at Mary's Naturally on Thursday, November the 23rd, from 11 a.m. 11 a.m., is she crazy? 11 a.m. on. Who's up at 11 a.m.?
I am.
Thanksgiving.
I am.
That's when you start basting the turkey.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, 11 a.m. Mary's will be providing the turkeys, and ICOH and Friends will be providing all of the side dishes. All are welcome. And
I guess
also,
you need to get an early start for that because, you know, the next
that's
morning.
That's an early start for that because then later on at 7 p.m. you run over to the Brazos River Bottom, 2400 Brazos, and join the festivities, food, and fun because a Thanksgiving dinner buffet at 7 p.m. is being sponsored by your friends and family, Southern Country Houston, the Colt 45s, the Rainbow Wranglers, and, of course, the BR.
Okay, Jimmy, let's get this
Thanksgiving
one,
Day.
One thing corrected
oops.
There.
Whoops, you're, time.
Oops.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a correction to make. That was last Thursday.
That was last Thursday. Never mind.
Okay. I was about to say, they had their Thanksgiving dinner on Thursday.
I didn't know that.
This past one.
I did not know that.
If you would show up on Wednesday. The third Wednesday of the month.
Well, Stanley's been in town, okay?
Oh, yeah,
There are priorities.
You've been doing double duty on the geriatric ward this
yes,
week.
Yes, okay, and you've got a few things to talk about.
Transgender Day of Remembrance. The Community Center family will join the Texas Association for Transsexual Support, which meets at the Community Center, for Transgender Day of Remembrance on Monday, November 20th, at the Holocaust Museum, Houston, 5401 Caroline. This internationally observed Memorial Day honors individuals murdered due to prejudice and hatred against transgendered people. doors open at 6:30 for a self-guided museum tour, and the program begins at 7. Followed by a panel discussion and reception with kosher refreshments.
Oh, kosher refreshments?
Speakers include local trans activists Liddy Rotter and Kristen Williams, who you've heard here, and also City Controller Anise Parker.
Well, it's being held at the Holocaust Museum.
Yeah. For more information, go to TGDOR, Transgender Day of Remembrance, .org, or HTUC.org.
HTUC?
Yeah.
Houston Transgender Unity Committee.
Bingo. They put the tuck in.
No. No.
I shouldn't go there.
Please don't.
H-tuck.
He went there.
He did.
World AIDS Day. The Community Center co-sponsored World AIDS Day Interfaith Service at Covenant Church, 4949 Caroline, on December 1st, 6 p.m. Additionally, the Community Center will also put up a Community Tree of Remembrance at the center at 3400 Montrose, Suite 207, on December 1st. We encourage individuals to bring ornaments in memory of friends and loved ones who have lost to AIDS throughout the entire month of December.
Yeah, they've done that every year at the Community Center.
Bring comfort and joy to the Houston children, infected and affected by HIV/AIDS this season by donating a toy to the NLA Ribbon Toy Drive, Red Ribbon Toy Drive, November 6th through December 8th. Please donate new unwrapped toys that are appropriate for children between birth. Well, they're saying birth and age 18.
Yes.
Well, they told us it's between birth and age 13. From 13 to 18, they're asking for a cash donation to give those kids a gift card.
Oh, okay. We'll read on.
NLA designated toy boxes are located in the following locations: the 611, In-N-Out, Black Hawk Leather, Leather Forever, Brazos River Bottom, Tony's Corner Pocket, George, Mary's, Chances, Michael's Outpost, Cousins, The Ripcord, Decades, Blur, EJ's, Hollywood, In-N-Out again, Energy, and Toys. The donations can be made in cash and check, payable to AFH. Will be available. You can pay that at the NLA event on December 1st, 8 to 9:30 at Mary's.
Naturally.
Toys will be accepted at this event. Anyone who's welcome, wants to perform, can talk to Daddy Rose.
Speaking of Daddy Rose, yes, and you did speak about her earlier. Got a little blurb from Daddy Rose. Rosemary Smith is her real name, that she has been accepted into the University of Houston for the spring semester, and she'll be pursuing the psychology degree that she started back in 1995.
All right. Way to go, Daddy Rose.
Well, she's a bartender. She's already a psychologist.
Is that her reason for giving me that drink?
No, that wasn't the reason.
That was called Payback's a Bitch.
Yeah, and the offspring's a mother.
Mm-hmm. Join us on November 21st at Tony's Corner Pocket. Miss Gaia.
Miss Gia.
Gia, Gaia.
No. Miss Gaia is something entirely different.
Gaio.
Yes.
G-I-A.
This is Gia.
Gia. Depends if you believe in Roman mythology.
That's G-A-I-A.
Yeah, okay, that's right.
Somebody wearing a dress is hosting a benefit along with Katrine.
Somebody carry my train for me, please.
Somebody walking into Tony's corner pocket with a dress and some duct tape is performing a benefit with Supreme for the PWA charities.
Oh, that's tacky, because Miss G is really, really nice.
Tacky isn't the word for it.
Well, if you get the low stick dick tape, it's not as tacky.
Gotcha.
It's an understatement.
Make it in colors, you know?
No, don't go there.
I've got a slightly colored green.
To match your underwear, okay.
Hot pink?
They have that.
Yes,
green
I noticed.
Three shades of green. I couldn't believe that.
As long as it's olive drab, it's in good taste.
Well, there's olive, lime, and I forget what the other one was.
Forest.
Remember, the forest. United States military only appreciates the color olive drab.
Gotcha.
Diva's Leftover Show starts at 7 p.m.
And there are so many.
Yes. Leftover Divas?
Yeah.
Or duct tape. Come and enjoy the leftovers.
Ooh.
Get rid of the ducks.
There we go.
At Tony's, where you'll get the full but won't get stuffed.
Ooh. Oh, no.
I guess you get stuffed at the hotel next door.
Yes.
December 16th, Miss Gia will be doing another benefit at Tony's Corner Pocket for the PW...
A? People with AIDS?
It's the same event a week earlier.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Just, you know, show up either the 6th... Oh, sorry. November 24th or December 16th.
Yes.
Miss Gia, Corner Pocket, used to be...
Keys West.
No longer the O?
Information. No, that's Blur now.
Okay.
Let's get to the good stuff. We're going to do self-promotion. You know, we love shameless plugs.
Stacy Needleway.
Stacy.
No, that's the one. I have Stacy Needleway.
Houston Arts Academy.
A very cult Christmas. The annual Christmas show and community awards at the home bar of the Cult 45, the VRB, on Sunday.
Sunday.
December.
Was that Sunday?
The 17th of December at 7 p.m. Fun, food, prizes. And the new wreath contest.
Yes.
You mean a month from today?
I think it says it on the next page. Yeah.
Instead of trees, you know, instead of the Martian butt plugs, they're going with the Martian cock rings.
There we go.
Uh-huh.
That's how they were promoting when they were handing them out.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
All proceeds of the wreath contest will benefit the Cold 45's AIDS Trouble Fund.
Yes.
That's the round and green thing you were talking about earlier?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
And if I get my act together, there will be a KPFT After Hours entry.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Good luck.
But then again, it comes from my mind.
Oh, no.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
Deep, dark, and twisted that avenue is.
Actually, I was thinking of two wreaths. I was going to make that one. I was going to do another one because of the tradition I have and the history I have with people. It was going to be stuff bought from the 99-cent store on the wreath.
Uh-huh.
But, I just don't know how you hang a can of Ethiopian Spam onto a wreath. Pretty good stuff, though.
Just read it, Mary.
The Cold 45s are excited to announce the annual Christmas event. This year, they handed out wreaths for individuals and organizations to decorate in any way they feel fit.
Yes.
Metacon.
Quite festive.
Or unfit.
Mm-hmm.
Our miniature tree cons decorating in the past, these wreaths will be auctioned off the night of the show. Each year we have a Christmas celebration with a fun show and the Cult 45 Community Awards. We are proud to announce this year's nominees. The Danny Villa Award.
Yes.
What about Danny Villa?
You need to hang around for at least this award announcement.
Yes, I know.
Danny Villa?
Danny Villa Award, named after an individual who was the forefront of people helping people with AIDS.
Yes, Danny Villa. You know those boxes you see in the bars where you put your change in? Danny Villa thought that up.
Given to a member of the community for their work not directly related to the Colt 45s. And the nominees are Blanche DeBrie, Sona Alton.
That's Dubois.
Jason Cryer.
Rusty, he is crying.
Rusty Rose, Jimmy Carper, and Lisa Ferranda.
Yes. All great folks there who really, really work for the community. Lisa has spent a major part of this past year emceeing so many fundraisers in the gay community. Also, she works at, she volunteers time at the Omega House.
Oh, nice.
I saw her over at the Mint Miss Julep, Miss Mint Julep contest where she was, where she auctioned off a tour of the KHOU studios.
Ooh.
Wow. Which would only be appropriate if we go nowadays, because, you know, when it's starting in December, their sign says, ho, ho, ho.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. I walked through the neighborhood the other day and yelled, ho, 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 and the pimp up to me and said, which one you want?
Careful, that's against the law now.
Ooh.
The Golden Colt Award, given to a member of the community for their work directly related to the Colt 45. And the nominees are Southern Country Houston, Don Gill, Misfits Houston, PWA Holiday Charities, and After Hours.
After Hours,
KPFT.
That's not fabulous.
After Hours.
And we are in good, I mean, look at the names on that list.
Yeah, it's amazing to see us nominated for anything. Sure as hell we don't see that now, Outsmart or The Voice or whatever the
name is. I'm just thrilled to death over this.
The B.J. Summers Memorial Entertainer of the Year Award, named in honor of a performer who did much for the Colt 45s, as well as many other organizations, given to a community performer. The nominees are Rusty Rose, Dee Dee DeMarco, Cheyenne, Christopher Prado, and Jim Crawford.
That is going to be a very, very tough category to
Christopher
to try.
Prado?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, you'll see him next week.
Sparkles.
Oh, yeah. Never mind.
Nowadays, he runs around with a sash and a kilt.
Uh-huh.
Normally, you see him with the kilt.
That's what I just wanted you to announce.
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
Well, I didn't tell you. Falcon told me that next week we will be having, hopefully, the Eresus candidate line, the two candidates for emperor and one candidate for empress.
Right.
You said Eresus?
Yeah.
Eresus.
Yeah, next week in the show, you can't swing a beaded purse without hitting a Chris.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Because they're bringing two.
Empire of the Royal Sovereign and Imperial Court of the Single Star.
Bibbidi-bobbidi-boo.
There you go.
Did you have the special music we were going to play before here?
I want to talk about Stacey Needlay.
Okay, well, I was going to
get... Stacey does need a leg.
Invite you.
Well, if his ass ever shows up here, he might get one. But, you know, he said, you know, when we moved to Saturdays, he was going to show up here. But I haven't seen that tattooed
ass. Stacey need a leg?
Stacey.
Oh, that's Stacey.
Never mind.
That's Stacey. I have got a story about that, Stacey. But this right
please.
Now...
Oh, please. What other story can you have after seeing him nude on the big screen?
No, no, no.
Keeping us on pins and needles.
Invite you to come join the madness December the 8th at the Brazos River Pod, BRB.
Hey, I'm the one who's supposed
Brazos.
To be slurring my words, not you.
Damn, I know.
What is
7:30 p.m. to celebrate the 28th anniversary of her 29th birthday.
Help us, please.
With the 28th to the 29th?
28th anniversary of the 29th birthday.
On Wednesday, they said that was the 29th of the 29th.
Whatever. With the madcap, crazy, silly show of Christmas and holiday songs.
Is that anything like Christmas and tuna?
Benefiting Resurrection MCC Food Pantry. Donations of non-perishable food items of canned meats, pasta, sides, soups, cereals, fruits, and such. Should be brought. Yes. So,
if I want meat, I don't want it canned.
Tell me about it.
Once again, we're talking about my
birthday request is for donations of food for the pantry, which will have donation boxes set up to receive her donations. This would be the best birthday gift I could receive to help persons in need of food and help them possibly have a better Christmas and holiday season. So, Stacey Needlay, December the 8th, we'll be talking about that in all the
We'll get you soon
weeks.
Enough, Christopher.
You bet.
And now, that's what you get for showing up on time for a change.
Brave on Stacy.
So what is it? Christopher's here?
Not that Christopher.
He's behind you. Not that Christopher. Not that Christopher.
Oh, okay.
The other Christopher.
I am so sorry. I didn't know you were here, dear, because...
You said you had a CD to play for this.
No, actually, it's a tape.
Oh,
it's in the tape
Lord.
Deck.
Oh, good. That means I get to shut your mic off. Then.
That's right.
That's right. This week is Black on Black, isn't
quite
it?
Quite a few years ago...
That's when we went from 4 hours to 3 hours.
Well, yeah, a blues show started.
And that wasn't too many weeks ago.
And it was headed up by a really nice guy, Jeffrey Kendrick. And he was known on the airwaves as Big Daddy J. That came through, an email came through this week announcing that he had died. And I'm really shocked at that because Big Daddy J is quite a bit younger than me.
Well, I remember it was about a year or so ago he had suffered some, I think it was a stroke.
Really?
So he did have some health concerns.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is one guy who came on after us, and he was never fazed by the circus of characters.
Oh, I know it. I know it. You know, he was such a... he was such a non-Montrosian.
Yeah.
You know, the only time he was around people like us was when he was here. I mean, they were not in his life at all, but he took it all in stride. And, you know, that 3-4 o'clock time slot is really tough to handle. So, you know, he'd be late every once in a while. So I, what I did was I taped his opening so that when he was running late, I would just play his opening and the Thrones and Janis Joplin or something, you know. Right. So, in memory of Jeffrey, Big Daddy J, here is the opening to his show.
for you, Big Daddy Che. We now go to our regular scheduled programming and play for the song that, of course, whenever I play it, it haunts me for about a week. I can't get it out of my head. It's time for Black on Black, and, of course, you know this music.
Welcome to the colored section. Welcome to the Negro League. Sign your name on the blacklist and know this. It's American history. See what it is to be blackmailed.
Blackmailed.
See a real life conspiracy. Sign your name on a blacklist and know this. It's American history.
Thank you for joining Christopher Evans on Black on Black on KPFT. In studio today, we have guests. Hooray! Wonderful, wonderful. I actually have a dear friend of mine, Miss Ashley, along with her amazing son, Mr. Smith, and they'll be joining us this morning. And what we're going to talk about is the myth that black women are unable to raise a black male child without him suffering some type of
shortcoming.
Thank you. I was trying to think of a word. So we're actually going to get started with you, Miss Ashley, and asking you, do you believe that black women are unable to successfully raise black male children, that they become viable, that they're successful in the world? Are there any obstacles, or do you think it's just virtually impossible for black women to successfully raise a black male child on their own?
Good morning. First of all, I think that it's possible for you to do whatever you set out to do. It's just really that simple. It's not that easy. There are some things that will come against you that you just are not equipped to deal with. There's some things that girls just don't know how to do. And sometimes you have to enlist help from other people in order to get this child from point A to point B. But it can be done. One of the things that I have a problem with, society as a whole seems to think that if you are missing the opposite of the female, then you hinder the child. But if you have the opposite that's actually in the life and not producing or showing the correct things, then you still have a child that is missing seeing some of those things in action, honesty, some of the things that we like to pour into our children. So if that person is there and does not have those characteristics, you still have a child that is only seeing one part of the picture.
Okay.
So, of course you can do it. It's not easy, but it can be done.
Mr. Smith, what do you think?
To be honest, I believe that any parent, be them male or female, can raise a child by themselves. Like my mom said, it's not going to be the easiest walk in the park, but it can be done as long as there's love, true love, in that mother-son, mother-daughter, father-son, father-daughter relationship, and as long as you got your head on straight.
Okay. I listened to a poem during Father's Day earlier this year by an artist by the name of Seven, and the poem started off wonderfully until it got to the part, and he was specifically talking about one man attempting to raise another man's child and him being considered not the biological father, but the father more in an emotional and supportive sense. And he got to a part in the poem where he said, and I'm paraphrasing, that there is an issue with black women raising male children, and the reason for effeminacy within the black community amongst black males is the direct result of that, of black women raising black male children, because there is no male figure in the household. My point on that was, I was raised by a single mother, a very strong single mother, and her, they're not being any male in the household had no reflection on what my characteristics were as a man. Do you, Mr. Smith, do you find, did you find it at all odd or strange or difficult to find out what your masculinity was, or what your manhood was, because there was not a man in the household?
Not at all. It was real simple for me to figure it out at a young age and grow into it now that I'm in an older age, because even though there wasn't a male in the household, you know, I saw other men out on the streets, and whether they were good examples or bad examples, I took what I could from them and put it into me, and decided that whatever knowledge I had got from them, I was going to use to either better myself and better my surroundings and help my mother out, or turn it into a negative and just fall into like a depressive stage and be non-useful, not useful to the society. So,
Mrs. Ashley?
I was just running that over in my mind, and I was just trying to think back to when I was, and I realize we're not talking about the girls, but I had a mother and a father, and I was a complete tomboy. I mean, I could whoop the biggest boy. As a matter of fact, I was taller than most of the boys in my neighborhood. I could jump fences, climb trees. I like frogs, and we caught bugs and things such as that. So I'm not understanding how we base a lot of things that we say, write down, write reports, write books, write poems on. It seems like sometimes we just get together and decide we'll just say this, and then somebody else hears it, reads it, and then runs with that particular theory, with not ever having anything to really support that. It's just what you think. I said all of that to say this. I don't see black mothers raising black male children being anything other than black male children seeing their mothers, their sisters, their aunts trying to help them get to one place, and that's better, further along than where they were.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really that simple. I don't understand the theory. I don't agree with the theory at all. It's just a bunch of poppycock, if you ask me. We're here. We have been for a long time, and we're producing many children, male and female, that are bettering the society as it is, period, in the absence of and along with our partners. So we're doing a great job, and I'd like to commend any parent, period, that has a child at all that is doing the right thing. I think that sometimes we get really burdened down with something to worry about. Many of our children are just perfectly fine, and they will be fine. A lot of the things that we can't find a time or know how to put into our children, there are some other people that are in our societies that step in to help us, such as our preachers, our teachers, some of the other parents, some of the children that have mothers and fathers in their homes. I know for a fact, even though we did not have a father, so to speak, we had plenty of children that I had to mentor to, or that found themselves in my home being given instructions such as I would give my own child. So just because you're out there by yourself does not mean that this child is just going to be wayward or anything else. There are many things that can be done and many things that we are doing as a society to help our children. It's just not so. It's just a lie.
Okay. One of the questions I was asked in a in a round circle meeting was, did I believe that I missed out on anything not having my father in the household? And it took me a while to think about that. And what I had to think about is that there were a lot of things that I had to learn on my own that just weren't specifically left to the learning of a male child, but things like learning how to shave or learning how to be a little bit more mechanical than my mother maybe could have even shown me. And in some rights, what has happened with having to learn those things on my own, I learned the hell out of those things. There's no doubt in my mind that I know how to do some things because, in fact, I had to learn how to do them by myself without the assistance of a man. And I remember one time something, and I don't think I've ever even told my mom. She told me we were coming downstairs from our apartment, and there's this little dog barking. And I'm looking at the dog like it was a Rottweiler. And my mom told me, she was like, be a man. And for about a long time, that hurt my feelings. And every time I saw a dog, I wanted to kick the hell out the dog because it would take me back to that moment in time. So there's some things that I have learned that I've had to learn on my own. And I'm grateful that it actually happened that way, though.
And I want you to know that I love you. I really do. And I think, and I understand the thought. I understand that. However, when is it that you get to a point where you take responsibility for what you just don't know and you just need to learn? Suppose you had had a father in your life that wasn't hairy and didn't shave, and you were. He still would not have taught you how to shave.
But in that,
suppose you had a father that was not mechanically inclined.
Uh-huh.
And he never taught you those things.
That's true.
And you needed to fix your car. So now, at this point, you had a father, but he never did teach you any of those things because he didn't possess that information himself. So now, at what point do you figure, this is my life, I have to make the best of it, and I missed out on some things, maybe, but we go forward from here. And if there is somebody that is at my disposal or in my warm circle of friends or wherever I can get that knowledge from, why isn't it that we can't go out and get that? As a mother, there's some things that I know how to do better than many men know how to do. And so, why is it that we have broken down these roles? When we were in growing up, my father cooked better than my mother. And there were many things that we learned how to do in the kitchen from my father and not my mother. So I think sometimes we just have things just a little bit confused. There are some things that... Let's all just take responsibility for our children and go forward from there.
And when I say things that you've learned from your father, I know once you get to a certain age, as any adult, despite what has happened in your past, you do have to take responsibility for that. However, as a 10-year-old, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, even 16, the mindset is not there to fully, not for every child to fully grasp the idea that, you know what, if I can't get this from a male figure in my life, then I'll have to learn it by myself. So a 10-year-old, I'm talking more around adolescent age, when that absence is there and the ability and the understanding to grasp the fact that I do not have a male figure in my life, and there are some roads I'll have to travel on my own, or some things I'll have to figure out without another male's point of view, because in some situations there's not another male figure, there's not an uncle or a friend in the family that can teach you. So at 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, how does that child at that age, who can recognize that there's not a male figure in my life, how do they get a handle or put their hands and mind around the fact that I'll have to learn some things on my own?
I think we have just completely let go of one another as a society of people, not just black people, but people, period, when there used to be a time when a whole neighborhood, no matter what color, no matter what age group, we would help each other with our children. When I was raising my child, there were many people that were in my life that helped me, and sometimes I didn't even know that they were helping me. Case in point, Ashlyn came to me one day, and he says, "Mom," he says, "I learned how to do something." And I said, "Well, good. You know, well, what did you learn how to do?" And he says, "I learned when you go to the restroom, you're supposed to take this finger and you rub it in between that finger and you get all of it out." And I was like, okay. As a female, I couldn't teach him that, and somebody else showed him that, and so they were helping me. What has happened is, yes, he's embarrassed completely. what has happened is we have let go of one another. Even if the child does not realize that there is something missing or that I need to gather this information from somewhere, there should be enough people, enough places, whether it's in our school system, in our churches, in our neighborhoods, that can look at a situation and say, "This child does not have this, and I have this time to donate to this child for the betterment of this child." And a lot of times we get caught up in how much money I can give or what I can donate or something like that, when in essence something just as simple as teaching or talking to somebody or somebody's child would make a very big difference in everybody's life.
Mr. Smith, how old are you now?
19.
What do you think is the most important thing that you've learned about life up to this point?
Most important thing that I learned about life is to always give back to what was given to you. Like, if the neighborhood gave to you, say, like, soccer team, give back to that soccer team, give back to that neighborhood, you know, always give back, so that way you can always refresh yourself. And it's like Bruce Lee once said, you know, stagnant water gets dirty, but water that always is constantly moving, it stays clean and is always refreshed.
Okay.
So always giving back is just something important to me and what I've learned through my whole life.
Well, I like that.
What do you think that the community could do in an effort to rear or to make a collective effort to raise black male children who may happen to be in a household without a father, be it from abandonment, be it from they're maybe away in the military, or maybe they've died tragically or passed on early on in life. What do you think the community could do in an effort? How could we go about, adult black men, go about bringing in black male children, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, and giving them some type of foundation for a relationship? Because I know one of the things for me, and I'm going to be honest on here, is that I have a very hard time bonding with other black men as far as friendship is concerned and having a relationship with them. I have to be honest, I don't know without some strain how to be friends with other black men. It has to be a situation that kind of forces the friendship. And so I don't know if you had that issue, or if you make friends very easily with other black men. I don't. I really don't. I mean, the black male friends that I do have, it's very few, but they're very quality. But as far as being out somewhere, you know, out in a public venue, it just doesn't happen that easily for me. And a lot of it has to do with my inability to either want to or the ability to appropriately communicate and approach?
Well, to answer your question, if I was to answer it any type of way, I would think that we as a black community need to stop looking down or showing pity to children that don't have father figures. We shouldn't pity them and then be like, oh, well, you know, the mother doesn't have a dad. Well, let's just give her money. Let's just do this. No. What we need to do is look at everybody as a human being and realize that, okay, he doesn't have or she doesn't have this right now. They don't necessarily need money or food or anything. Just spending like 5 minutes with a child, teaching them how to play chess or teaching them to play checkers could do a whole world's good, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And as far as connecting with each other, we need to remember that everything that we take in on a day-to-day basis is knowledge, whether we want it or not. It's knowledge, and it has some use. Like, I see drug dealers out on the street every now and again. Most of the time. I'm not going to lie to you. But that knowledge that I have is, okay, they are doing drugs. They're selling drugs. They're making money the illegal way. Now, I have the choice to do it the illegal way, too, and risk going to jail and being somebody's friend, quote unquote.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio, KPFT, Houston 90.1 FM, and Galveston 89.5 FM.
I played the voice for you.
You did that on purpose, didn't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I know you did. Okay.
Well, I know that's your favorite ID.
Woo! Back to Mr. Smith.
And then taking the information in, I have to realize that they are doing what I perceive as wrong. Now, no matter what, it's still information that I need to hold on to.
Okay.
So that I can know what's right to me, and I can use that and see what not to do, what not to let come around my children that I'm going to have, or my family members.
Okay.
So, just to remember that everything is knowledge, and you have to use it some type of way. And don't let anything just slip through your fingers. Or through your mind, for that matter.
Okay. Back to you again. Manhood. What is your definition of manhood? You want to give me a little time to think about it?
Yeah, okay. Give me a minute.
Miss Ashley, as a mother and a female, what do you think your, or not what do you think, what is your definition of manhood?
My definition of manhood is the ability, and some people just don't have it, the ability to take care of, be a protector of a family. Those things that we hold sacred as girls, we usually step outside of that after we've gotten past, you know, our parents, and we start looking for somebody to surrogate into our lives. And so when I think about manhood, I think about a male being able to take on the responsibility for himself first and to be able to facilitate other people, such as a wife and or children, a protector, a provider. Those are the things that I associate with manhood. That's what it means to me.
And as a mother, how did you inject that or relay that to your son?
We talked about it earlier. There were things that I could say to him, such as, once you get at this age, you are going to be expected to. I would like to see you be able to do this. All of the time teaching him that this is how you take care of you, and you can't actually take care of anybody else if you can't take care of you can't take care of anybody else if you can't take care of you.
these are the things that we put into all of our children's lives, though. This was the same thing that was taught to me from my mother. And it just so happened to be that this was her ideal of womanhood. So what I'm saying is, there were some things that I didn't know how to do. I was not familiar with, simply because my makeup of my body was not the same as his. However, the core of what it takes is spread across both genders.
Mm-hmm.
It's basic information. And it just so happens that he is a male child.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the things that are important, and a lot of times if we break them down to the very simple core, that's what they are. Responsibility for your actions, love for yourself. Those things came easy to me, and I believe that's why he has and many of the other Black male children have turned out the way that they have, because this is not a magic potion that we're pouring over our children, or that we're doing something so wonderful and great. These are simple values that come from simple values that have been passed down and taught, and it's just other things, sexuality, how men communicate with each other is very different from how women communicate with each other. And a lot of times I saw this being added to Ashlyn's life on a level that I did not know how to operate on or didn't understand. So I gave him that foundation, and that was passed on from my parents and the things that we believed. One of the things that I'd like to mention is when he first started to move out into the sports arena, play
Soccer, swim team,
things such as that. Yes. Okay. And I didn't do any of that. I didn't. And we would take him and we would sit there. And I remember one day he was at karate practice, and the instructor told him to go across the room and get something. And he pointed to the left, and Ashlyn moved to the right. And the man grabbed him just forcibly by his arm and just slung him around and pushed him in the direction that he was supposed to go. And it irritated me so bad as the parent, because in my mind I was thinking, you know, he is jerking my baby around. You know, I wanted to fight him. And then after I saw this happen a couple of times, it made me understand better that this was how men relate to each other. I didn't know anything about that. It wasn't a secret. It was just that I wasn't a man. Mm-hmm. And it was okay. He would talk to my child really rough, and I didn't understand, and it irritated me because that wasn't the way I talked to him. So I said all of that to say that in the community, in school, and things like that, he learned how to relate to different men, mm-hmm. or relate to different situations as a man in school and in sports situations.
Okay.
And I didn't know. It was a learning experience for me. And many times I wanted to get involved and say something as the parent, as the mother, and it was brought to my attention sometimes by other men that he's leave him alone. He'll mm-hmm. be fine, and he's okay. So I had to leave him alone.
And let me know, you are, what belt are you now?
First degree black belt in two styles. But I'm going for my second this year, but I have to have two yellow belts under me to get my second degree.
Okay, and what do you mean you have to have two yellow belts?
Meaning that I have to have taught two of my own students and
okay.
got them to the next level before I can get to my next level. So
okay.
it's just like that giving back to the community thing. And I'm not sure if you were done, Mom, but I'm cutting you off.
Thank you. Nice of you to let me know.
I love you, too.
I love you, too.
Godliness is my definition of manhood.
Okay.
Because that sums up pretty much everything my mom said. It's like, he protects us. He loves us. He spends quality time with us. He lets people that are good for us come into our lives, and then he lets us go out on our own every now and again and lets people that are not so good for us come into our lives.
Okay.
To see how we would react to that situation.
Okay.
And what we would do. So therefore, if I was created in his image, then that's what I am.
Okay. I'm going to ask a question, and I'm going to give you my answer. At what age, Ashlyn, did you recognize or sense the transition from childhood to manhood? And at what age did you feel
that? It was a very early age for me, because being raised by my mama, I had a very high intelligence. And it was brought to my attention one night, and my mom was out with a couple of friends, and they were all out on one of my quote unquote extended family aunt's porch, and they were drinking beer or smoking or doing
tell it all of your business.
Yes, they were just doing what they do, and all the kids from the neighborhood were at one of her friends' house named Treese.
Okay, I'm
and fine. She wanted Treese wanted me to come over, because the only time that her children act civilized was when I was around.
Okay.
And I took it as, and I was like, out of the whole group, it was one child that was older than me.
Okay.
And I took it like, after that night, I thought about it, and I sat back and I was like, how is it that I got a 13-year-old when I'm 10 and I got 6, 7, and 5-year-olds mimicking my every move and acting patient and with some respect at that age? I didn't understand it. And then, like, it came to me that same night. Like, I woke up in the middle of the night, and it was like, they look up to me.
Okay.
Even though I'm younger than one of them, they look up to me.
Okay.
And they see something in me that they want.
Okay.
So from that point on, I was like, okay, well, I'm a role model. So this is something, a quality that a man has.
Okay.
Is a role model. And from that point on, I knew, like, where my place was. I still had some bumps, trials, tribulations, and some more stuff to learn. But from that point on, I knew, okay, this is what a man is. I've got there. Let's just even it all out.
Okay. Well, hell, you make me sound retarded, because I didn't get it till I was 30 years old.
But that's not, it's just not
it
the
is.
Call. Not the call for everybody, and we learn things on different cycles. And one of the things that we do a lot of times is we beat ourselves up if we're not in a place by a certain time, so says somebody else. Period. So let it go. We love you, and you're not retarded. And you just didn't come into that at that age.
But I feel, because you were how old? Did you say 10? 10. So I'm 20 years late. I was 20 years late on mine. But it actually didn't hit me until, and it didn't hit me until I was 30 years old that I was a grown man. Mm-hmm. And that I could do anything mm-hmm. I wanted to do. Now, I would have to pay the consequences for that.
Right.
But it didn't hit me until I was 30. There was still this child man mentality that there's a difference in your walk when you understand that you're mm-hmm. a grown man mm-hmm. or that you're a grown woman.
Right.
There's a certain way that you walk. There's a certain way that you talk to people, and you can approach people. And I didn't get that until I was a good 30 years old, and it was an epiphany just from out of nowhere. I can't even recall what actually happened to bring that about. But it was, if you got the feeling at 10 that I got at 30, then that was a wonderful feeling.
Like, I'm not saying that, like, I held on to it because I was 10. But I had it. Like, that totally tripped me out. I had, like, 13 kids in that household that were listening to me.
Mm-hmm.
Sit down. Don't do that. Stop doing that. Sit down. Watch the movie. Go get the popcorn. Stop hitting your sister. And I'm 10.
Okay.
It hit me. And, like, maybe some years after that, I, you know, because every child needs a childhood. You know, maybe the next day or 2 months after that, I might have, like, went back to my childhood.
You digressed.
We all tend to go back there sooner or later. Even if you're 34, sooner or later you're going to ride a motorcycle, and that's you going back to your childhood. But at that age, it hit me, and I realized that I had a bigger part in life to play than what I had thought at first.
Okay.
And then, like, you made a comment. I had always known that I had my own choice. It was my free will. I had the choice not to go to school. And that's because my mama instilled that in me. Because she's, quote, unquote, got a psychiatry label somewhere down there. I forget if it's a degree or something. But she used to play mind games with me a lot. Oh, well, baby, you don't have to go to school, but this is what's going to happen in the near future. So she always let me know.
That was not a mind game.
Anyway, like I said.
That was laying out the consequences of not doing what I informed you was what you needed to do.
But you used to do it.
It's simple.
No, it wasn't as simple how you used to put it, and you still do it. And it's not as simple as you say.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that you missed out on anything?
Not one thing at all. Because my mom put certain male figures in my life. And I put certain male figures in my life to help me get to where I know I needed to be.
Okay.
My karate teacher, I knew first and foremost that I needed to know how to fight. I knew he was going to be the one to teach me how to do it. And I knew I needed to control my anger all at the same time. I've seen other karate teachers, but I knew that he was the one that could do the whole thing. She had male friends that come into life and leave out or whatever, but they help set up the foundation. I don't think I missed out on anything not having my father in there. To be honest, the only thing that I think I missed out on is not knowing if I have other family members out there. Like, I know I have an older sister and I know I have an older brother, which I'd like to meet. Mm-hmm. And that's the only thing I think I missed out. Now, him being in my life, he didn't have to be in my life. All I want to do is meet my younger brother and my sister and maybe get some medical records from him, because we all need to have those medical records.
I've wondered for years, had I missed out on anything? And I didn't want my mother to be offended in my quest to figure out had I missed out on anything. So I never really brought it up to her, but we talked about it one day, and she kind of felt like, you know, had your father been in your life, then some things would have been different. And then one day I realized that it went down the way it was supposed to go down.
Right, exactly.
It happened exactly the way that it was supposed to happen.
And made you who you are.
And made me who I am.
Right.
And what has happened now is that I had some uncles in my life who would not give me the time of day. Mm-hmm. And they always told my mother, oh, you know, you need to watch out for him. You know, you're a single parent. We don't know how he's going to turn out. And now at this stage and age of my life, they want to spend time with me, calling me.
Right.
Well, why won't you come pick me up and spend some time with me? You didn't build that type of relationship with me, so you have to suffer the consequences. No football game, basketball game. You never did any of that for me. And I really had to think about, did I miss out on anything? And actually, no.
Right.
I didn't. And what it does is for a lot of men, once they realize and come to the realization that you didn't miss out on anything, that leaves you only responsible for everything that's going on in your, because you didn't miss out on anything. Now, if you want to get down to the Paul, there may have been some financial assistance that could have went on, but there's strength in struggle. So when you learn, or when you can make it through a low point, that builds character and it builds strength. So I had to realize I didn't miss out on anything.
Right.
But it was good time having that pity party sometime, you know, just crying and falling out and, oh, this could be so different.
Uh-huh.
And come to get your off the flow. There's nothing wrong with you. And my quest and my hope for the black community is that they learn that if in fact we find it so disdaining that black women are having to raise black male children don't get on the mothers.
Right.
Let's address the fathers who have made a decision to walk away. And one of the problems I had was, you know, I was going to play Fantasia's baby mama.
Oh,
and you, no. Your face turned three shades of red.
And I like the song. I really do.
And the reason why I couldn't figure out why people had such a bad taste in their mouth about the song. And I think the part people had a problem was, the part that people had a problem with was the part where she says, being a baby's mama is like a badge of honor.
Yes.
And they were like, where is the honor in? Well, where is the honor in her having to do it by herself anyway? Where is the honor in the father walking away? So if we're going to place blame and try to criticize, let's criticize the party that has decided to walk away. And don't let me get this twisted, there are single fathers out there right now who are doing the exact same thing. It's just the numbers are different. There was a young man in, was it New York? He was raising his 2-3-year-old,
mm-hmm.
And they featured him on a popular TV news magazine,
mm-hmm.
About him going to school full time and working full time, and two idiots decided to take his life one day when he was coming from work. But there are single fathers out there that are doing the same thing.
And please, let's not downplay the role that we have as a society, as people, period. There is something to be said for surrogates. We all have a responsibility. We all live here together, and these are all our children. These are all going to be our leaders one day. We have to take that responsibility as a nation of people. There is something for you to do. There is something for you to give. Just because you were not there during the exchange does not mean that you turn your back or close your eyes to the situation. There's something for you to do. There are some children that are out there that need you. When was the last time you volunteered to read at your local library? When was the last time you took someone's child and just offered to comb their hair? When was the last time you drug more than just your child to the neighborhood barbershop? When was the last time you took maybe two or three extra children to the baseball game or to the football game? These are the things that we need to look at instead of pointing blame. He didn't do and she didn't do. What can I do should be the question that we should ask, period. Not just for our black children, but for all children that may be absent anything. I often see the commercials on the television with the children that are hungry, and we talk about how many cents a day for a year it would take to make Marianne, you know. Okay, that's wonderful, and we need that, but how much of your personal time are you willing to give mm-hmm. up so that Marianne or Bobby Joe would have a firm foundation in their mind, settled in their spirit about who they are, and all it would take is for you to spend a couple a moments extra
mm-hmm.
with them. Some of the institutions that we have, Big Brothers and Big Sisters, these programs are just wonderful, and we don't hear a lot about them anymore, but things like that are desperately needed on a grand basis in our communities. But I think we can start at a small level and work right in our communities, okay. In our churches, and in this ridiculous topic that we're discussing here, we could just put this one to bed and move on to something else.
Chris, could you do me a favor? Could you look up the phone number for Big Brothers and Big Sisters, the local Houston chapter?
Big Brothers, Big Sisters?
Yeah, local Houston chapter. We can give anyone in the listening audience that phone number who would actually like to volunteer for that. Do you plan on having children, Ashley? Or would you like to have children?
It has recently been brought to my attention that no matter what I try to do, I'm going to have twins, so it's going to happen.
What do you think will be the number one thing that you instill, whether it be you have a little girl or a little boy, what will be the number one thing that you instill in them at an early age?
To treat everybody with
respect, because I noticed, like, in a lot of people, young youth my age, we're always, we're not looking at everybody as humans. We're looking at them as their clothes. We're looking at them as their jewelry.
Okay.
And we're not seeing the real person. We're missing out on good friends because they don't hang with the popular kids. Or
okay.
We're missing out on good friends because their hair is pink, green, and purple all at the same time, and mine is black. Nah, it's not supposed to be like that. So when I do have children, I'm going to instill to look at everybody as a human.
Okay.
And there's nothing else. I don't want to have any child that's like spoiled. I'm going to spoil my kids, but I don't want them to be spoiled to where they're like, oh, well, you don't have the new gaiters on, so you can't talk to me.
Okay. Miss Ashley, you have any last words?
Oh, I'm not having any more kids.
You're not?
You say that.
You're not having any more.
No, so I'm not going to instill anything else. Thank you.
You have that, Chris?
The main office for Big Brothers Big Sisters is 713.
Okay.
271
okay
5683, or you can always go on the web at BBBS Houston, Big Brother Big Sister Houston .org. And if you didn't get that number, I'm pretty sure if you call 211, you should be able to get that, because they are a part of the United Way.
Okay, thank you so much for that. Well, if we have no last statements, I thank you both for coming on. The last comments are is that if you are a single parent, and you did, no matter what race or nationality you are, I applaud you for the courage and the strength in actually doing that and doing a great job at it. Despite there could be two people in the household and you could still have a dysfunctional child, but if you are a single parent and you're raising a child with all of the love and heart and emotion and passion that you can muster going from day to day, I applaud you for your strength and your tenacity in doing so and making sure that that child is raised with the morals and the stamina that the society needs today. And from me to you, my wish is reflected in a song that was originally done by Nancy Wilson and remade wonderfully by Regina Bell. And to Miss Ashley and Mr. Smith, I've been friends with Miss Ashley, it's been over 10 years now, and I met Mr. Smith when he was, oh gosh, what, 9 or 10? He was a young man.
11, 13.
No, you were younger than that. Yeah, you were younger than that. And he has grown into an absolutely astounding young man. His ability to show responsibility has astounded me at times. And I just pray that I'm half the man he is one day. I applaud you for everything that you've done and the path that you've decided to take and the wonderful intelligent choices that you've made. And Miss Ashley, you could not have done a better job if there were five of you. And so I congratulate you and applaud you. And again, to all of those parents, single parents, who are diligently raising their children to the best of your ability and instilling into them all of the things that will help them grow, I give you this from me to you.
If I could, I'd protect you from the sadness in your eyes, give you courage in a world of compromise. Yes, I would. If I could, I would teach you all the things I've never learned. Cross the bridges that I burned. Yes, I would.
to the colored section. Welcome to the Negro League. Sign your name on a blacklist and know this, it's American history. See what it is to be blackmailed.
Blackmailed.
See a real life conspiracy.
Ooh.
Sign your name on a blacklist and know this, it's American history.
Supposed to put the mics on now, or is I going to do more music?
No.
I said as you're swallowing.
Yes, thank you. So very little.
So infrequently you're swallowing, so.
Yes,
hold on, I got to push this button,
Uh-huh.
Because I think he'll want his CDs back.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Yeah, he tried to confuse me by putting two CDs in one case.
Trying to keep you on your toes.
Well, fortunately, she was on top.
You're so nasty.
She was. You got jazz on the bottom.
Okay. He went there.
He's never seen a woman on top, so I don't know why we're having this discussion.
Of course not. I don't have Cinemax.
Okay.
Showtime doesn't go that often.
There we go. That's much better.
Personally, I didn't want to push your button.
Okay, I know. But
I'm lying, so I still got the cassette button pushed.
Christopher always does a very, very good segment.
Yeah, when he's here.
Ooh, ouch. Speaking of not being here, next week we're going to do a phone interview because last month we got stood up.
She was sick.
Okay, well.
Didn't I send you the email?
No.
Oh. No, wait, she called me. That's right, she called.
Yes, because you weren't here.
She called me on my cell phone.
I see. No, I didn't know about that. Because I'm scheduling a phone interview next week. Anyway, something interesting came to me over the internet, and
sadly, it's on paper. I had something interesting coming to me over the internet yesterday, yes. But you know,
the original.
I had to say no. For those of you on Dateline, I said no.
That middle square, the original person who sat in the middle square.
Oh, you're confusing people, you know.
Why?
He's been
Paul Lynde.
Yeah, I know. He's been gone for how many years?
Oh, quite a few. But
the guy whose voice you hear on that sounds like him on American Dad, the alien.
Oh, but he had some great answers to some questions, and so Chris is going to do the questions. I'm going to do the answers. Now, the first one I want to leave till last.
And the bonus point is if you figure out who asked the questions back then.
Yeah. The first one I want to leave till last.
Oh, the one that goes in. Oh.
Yes, that one.
According to the old song, at night, when you're asleep, into your tent I'll creep. Who am I?
The Scoutmaster.
God, he still can't get a faggy enough voice for Paul Lynde.
Oh, God.
I'm trying to do the other guy's voice. Do female frogs croak?
If you hold their little heads underwater long enough.
Paul, can you get an elephant drunk?
Yes, but he still won't go up to your apartment.
I think you need a snicker after that one. Prometheus was tied to the top of a mountain by the gods because he had given something to man. What did he give us?
Well, I don't know what you got, but I got a sports shirt.
You know...
Keep going.
Do I have to?
Yes, you do.
Can I get suspended again immediately?
No.
Oh. Damn.
From midair?
Homophobe.
Come on.
Oh, darn. They didn't take me away.
Yeah.
Is Billy Graham considered a good dresser?
No, but he's a terrific end table. Keep going. It gets better.
Says you. Is using an electric vibrating machine a good way to lose weight?
That's what I told the sales lady, but she just winked.
Oh, God. How many more pages are left? When is it a good idea to put your pantyhose in the microwave oven for 2 minutes?
When your house is surrounded by the police.
That makes no sense.
He was wearing the pantyhose. He was in drag. And he's hiding his drag in the microwave when the police came. Hello. God. It's so not funny when you have to explain it.
It's so not funny before you explained it. Why do sheep sleep huddled up?
Because little boy blue's a weirdo.
I can't wait until I get to the end of the page. Oh, thank God, he scratched out something. Why couldn't you scratch out more? When you pat a dog on its head, he'll usually wag his tail. What will a goose do?
Make him bark.
Okay, that one... Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll give you that one. You get a half a point. Is it considered in bad taste to discuss two subjects at nudist camps? One is politics. What's the other?
Tape measures.
Paul, why do Hell's Angels wear leather?
This is my favorite one. Because chiffon wrinkles too easily.
Paul, in ancient Rome, bakers were required by law to bake something into each loaf of bread. What?
A Christian.
Who are more likely to be romantically responsive? Women under 30 or women over 30?
I don't have a third choice.
And ladies and gentlemen, the final question!
Yay! Okay.
Channel Johnny Carson there on this one. In the movies, Frankenstein's monster was always big and ugly and had lots of scars. What was his biggest fear?
That the girls would be turned off by his big nuts. You know, the screws in his neck. Hello.
I'm sorry, I guess these jokes are you know, lost on people who were born after his death.
Oh, God, is it time? It must be time for the poetry.
Yeah, because sadly it's way past time for last call. I don't know if you've been bringing this out. I wouldn't have smoked this cigar, because you know.
Weren't you going to do a tribute to Chances?
I didn't pull out that CD.
It's right behind you. Over to your side.
No, you had the old CD out.
Oh, that's the new one?
Yeah, you have the new one. It's on the old CD.
Oh, okay.
I'll get it. I'll dig it out.
He'll dig it out.
You
well, I guess you had to be Paul Lynde then, because his delivery on these was priceless, absolutely priceless. He was so queer before anybody else was out. Everybody knew it, and nobody talked about it. And unfortunately, in real life, he was just an evil, alcoholic old queen. But...
Yes.
He did do some, you know, he did the father in Bye Bye Birdie. He had a recurring role on Bewitched as the uncle. And he was part of the foundation for gay characters on TV.
Let's do a little quick music interlude here.
Yes.
You know, a little sorbet for the mind to try and flush this out.
Thank you.
We dedicate this song to the patrons of Chances.
Yes, we do.
And if you know, I'm the one who's dedicating the song.
It's Jay Spears.
Be Afraid. Jay Spears from the old CD, House on Fire.
That doesn't sound like House on Fire.
Wrong Jay Spears song.
Gotcha.
You're getting on like a house on fire. Because of his incendiary charms, we had to disconnect all the smoke alarms. I gotta say, he's a real live wire, because we're getting on like a house on fire. House on fire, house on fire, we're getting on like a house on fire. If I said we weren't, I'd be some kind of liar, because we're getting on like a house on fire. He's big! Like a guard or a tackle, he's burning me up with a crackle, crackle, crackle. He makes me sing like the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. And we're getting
holding on like a house on fire. Make a fireman come. He's everything my heart could desire, and we're getting on like a house on fire. House on fire, house on fire, we're getting on like a house on fire. If I said we weren't, I'd be some kind of liar, because we're getting on like a house on fire. He's big, like a guard or a tackle. He's burning me up with a crackle, crackle, crackle. He makes me sing like the Mormon tabernacle. Getting on like a we're getting on like a house on fire, house on fire. We're getting on like a house on fire. If I said we weren't, I'd be a big fat liar. We're getting on like a house on fire, house on fire. We're getting on like a house on fire. If I said we weren't, I'd be a goddamn liar. We're getting on like a house on fire.
And that's dedicated to the patrons of Chances and their accidental fish fry they had last Tuesday.
Oh, he went there.
Yeah, for those of you who didn't know, it actually made the Houston Chronicle.
Yes, it did.
There was a
small fire.
Small fire at Chances during their singer-songwriter performance. She looked up and, you know, not often you see have a flamer at Chances.
There you go.
They're more bullish. And
that's why we played that song, House on Fire.
And so, but they unlike other gay bars, they managed to get it put out before it crumbled to the ground.
Well, they didn't want to remodel, probably.
Oh, why not? You know, there was enough, they probably had enough contractors in the bar at the time to have put up a really nice place in 3 days.
There you go.
That's the problem, you know. We've had all these other fires here, and the Nelly Little Queens couldn't put it out, but
those lesbians can do it.
There you go.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to go there how they put up the
okay.
fire. But hey, it's time.
It's way past time.
Pelletier Preservation and Revitalization Project.
What?
That's the name of the show, the Poetry
he came up with
Preservation and Revitalization Project.
Yeah,
there was a longer version.
His handwriting's atrocious.
Time.
I had to ask for it there.
And you know, anyway,
his
we're back.
PPRP?
Well, yeah, I guess you could call it that.
Paper rip.
Like PPRP, like people who need people, PPRP or something.
P
I don't
squared
know.
RP.
Yeah, there you go. I like that. P squared RP.
R and in the middle of P.
Yeah, I like
I'll
that.
I'll shut
actually.
Off our mics until,
anyway.
Until I forgot to break in at the top.
All right, so we're back and haven't been on the air for some months. I don't even know how many. My health was a little odd, and that's been more or less resolved. So it's going to be a little bit of a different structure in terms of how the history lesson happens today. That's going to be in the hands of my guest. But I'm going to read a very short poem of my own to start off, just to kind of let you know where I am these days. So, my heart breaks every time it can. It loves to do that. It keeps it fresh and strong. No, I don't mean it gets damaged and done wrong. Yes, it's with something so beautiful, you know it won't last. Yet the heart aspires for it too, keeps all the traces, keeps itself tuned, so that all the beauty is coming and going all the time in every form. It's reborn and survives you. A blessing always carries through and passes on. Living among the lost can sometimes have a cost. So always remember, when push comes to shove, the only answer is love. So, on that note, I'm going to read the first stanza of a Buddhist blessing to set the tone and to start off the history lesson. So, and it's by Kenpo Tulstrom Gyatsamo or something like that. Buddha nature blesses Buddha nature. Radiant clarity blesses radiant clarity. Through one essence blessing another, May the essence be realized. Look nakedly at the radiant clarity in the Buddha nature and rest relaxed within it. So, my guest tonight is Paul Smith, who I've known off and on for quite some time. We sort of cross paths every now and then and always have an interesting time. And he's a poet and also does performance art and dance and has worked at the Museum of Fine Arts and works at the Art Institute now. Part of his performance art stuff is in the form of dance, and he's performed in New York and at diverse works, and I'll let him say a little bit more about who he is. And then he's also going to talk about an aesthetic rapture tradition that he's somewhat explained to me, but I don't quite understand yet, so he's going to tell us all about it. It's an ancient tradition that's being restarted or something. So anyway, Paul.
Well, we share a lot of things also with Buddha Dharma and with the Shambhala mm-hmm. Institute and with their commitment to the arts and poetry.
Right.
And I might want to get you to talk about gays in Buddhism and poetry and the arts. I think that might be an interesting...
Sure.
Because I did take a workshop with Allen Ginsberg
before
he passed, and at the Naropa Institute, and met Ann Waldman. And it was a very profound and very transforming experience just to be there. And I think that's an important part of our history as well.
Right. Well, yeah, one thing I can say is that I know that there have been times where people have asked Dalai Lama about sexuality and gay sexuality, and he's given somewhat ambiguous answer early on, then he clarified it later because he realized that by being ambiguous he was inviting, you know, a propensity towards prejudice and hate crimes. But in general, because there's rules about do no harm and conduct in terms of sexuality on some of the basic purification levels of Buddhism, where you have very strict behavior in lots and lots of areas, whether you're heterosexual or homosexual. Other areas, it's not so much like that, other traditions of Buddhism. But anyway, in Buddhism, and specifically in the Shambhala lineage, I've encountered, you know, I've been involved with it over 30 years, and I've encountered less homophobia and more openness to whatever relationships form in whatever way. Again, with the idea of not doing harm to people doing harm to each other, but helping to realize their true nature.
But also, if I can interject, I think that at the core of Buddhist teachings, because they believe in this sort of non-tangibility of the self,
right,
that allows for a lot more freedom or flexibility in identity, which is sort of closed off in other systems. But I also want to talk about the people and Allen Ginsberg.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, those people that Buddhism meant so much to them, and he really synthesized, aside from Shogyam Trungpa, who was himself very committed to the arts and aesthetic vision, Ginsberg was as well, and actually formed the poetic school in Shambhala.
Yeah, him and Ann Waldman created the Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics, which is a great name. Because he had read Kerouac's Mexico City Blues, I think, to him driving up to Vermont to a meditation retreat one time. And Chogyam said that it was a perfect exposition of mind, the way mind works. And so when they formed the school and the Naropa formed, they decided to dedicate it to the disembodied spirit of Kerouac, him and Ann Wallman. And Ann Wallman is explored all areas of her sexuality in her poems and all that, too. And
she's an amazing being, too. I was very impressed with her, just almost really without any ego, but having a very, very strong sense of presence.
She's somebody you can look up to. Annewaldman. There's tons of stuff if you Google her, or, you know, Yahoo or whatever.
But those people are remnants from that period in the Beat Generation, and there's a gap, and the amount of tradition and the amount of exploration and the amount that Eastern philosophy had for them, for giving them permission to sort of explore different aspects. I kind of come into that exploring the Hindu tradition, although not strictly Hindu, but in the India or Indic context, of Abhinava Gupta, who was considered in India one of their prime philosophers in the first millennium. He was a true polyglot and synthesized so many different strains of thought. But you can do a search on any regular academic database and type in his name, and so much research is being done, bringing him back into dialogue and study, particularly in terms of post-colonial studies, because, you know, there's the implication that, well, Indians couldn't have any substantial, but the sophistication and subtlety of his thought with language and with interpretation is being reinterpreted by many scholars in many different traditions.
And what were, you know, what was he about? I mean, what were some of his ideas about?
Well, it's interesting.
You know, spirituality, and I guess, and connected to poetry, since this
exactly,
is a poetry show.
Exactly. Well, India has one of the oldest traditions of treatises on dance and drama, which classical Indian dance, which I've studied, the Natya Shastras are based upon. He did a reinterpretation of that, but it's a very unique symbol that India actually privileges dance. Dance and drama are synonymous in India,
right.
And they go together.
And they're a form of teaching all the legends and the history and the philosophy.
Exactly. But what's so interesting,
in a sort of non-intellectual, more direct way.
Right. They privilege dance and drama and also poetry because they consider them the most internal forms of art, as opposed to architecture, as opposed to painting or sculpture. And I've written an article about that in Art Lies a number of years ago, called The Theater Under Construction, just sort of contrasting it to the West, how we tend to privilege things that are more exterior. And I see that happening even more and more today. It's an interesting contrast. And I sort of worry and wonder about our own cultures, America's culture today.
You don't hear much about inner beauty these days.
yeah, and actually someone on the news came up with a whole segment. They did a piece, it was just on the regular news on television, called The Culture from Outside. And it really stuck with me, and I find that happening more and more. America has a very rich poetic tradition, and one of the things besides Buddhism and Indian or Eastern philosophy that influenced the Beat Poets was Walt Whitman.
Right.
And we have really deep, entrenched, radical...
Yeah, well, it's, you know, in terms of all the Hindu and the Buddhist philosophy, there's this whole cycle of life that replays, and the wheel turns, and we're in the Kali Yuga, and we're in the Dark Age now, where it's harder to stay awake, harder to have light. And the whole idea of the idea that when inside and outside are in sync, that seems to be the best.
Mm.
It can be pretty horrifying to be in sync. So you have to appreciate the sort of horror as well as the beauty in terms of ecstasy. In sync in a dark age like this.
Well, that's also, just on an aside, that's very interesting about the whole notion of their dramatic theory is based on this very non-hierarchical system of different flavors of drama, and they're not given a hegemony, they're not given a hierarchy, and horror and disgust are actually considered with the same respect as the more noble emotions that drama is supposed to evoke. It's endlessly fascinating.
Well, it takes everything to play out whatever needs to be played out.
But what's so fascinating about Abhinavagupta's thought is that we have all of these notions about Tantra that they are all obsessed with sexuality. And what's another hidden aspect of his thought is the other aspect of Tantra is language.
Right.
And is the fact that even Kali, her skulls that she wears as a necklace are actually symbols.
And Kali is a mother goddess, an aspect of the female deity, and she basically cuts through everything. She devours everything. She kind of cleans up after all the destruction in some sense. And also just, you know, doesn't brook any nonsense.
Exactly. And the skulls that she wears are symbols of the Sanskrit letters of their alphabet. And not limiting it to Sanskrit, Abhinavagupta took a very sort of postmodern attitude towards language and admitted that even animals have language since they seem to understand each other. So it's a principle of...
That's interesting because Mike McClure, who was a Beat poet, did all those poems that were animal noises.
Mm.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's to show the universalism of his thought, which is probably why a lot of contemporary scholars are re-looking at his work. But I have a poem which would probably be very
wonderful.
Appropriate.
Great.
And I read it at the International Poetry Festival. It's called Matrika Shakti. Shakti is the female deity power in Hinduism and Buddhism, which they reverse the Western notion, sexual polarity, where the feminine... The classical example is Shiva, or the male deity, is the concept of fire, is the idealism, whereas Shakti is its power to burn.
Okay, and Shiva is the destroyer. He's part of the Hindu trinity at the top of the deity list.
But he's also the patron of dance.
Right, exactly. And the whole idea that the world ends when his dance starts. And you'll see the iconography of like a wheel of fire and this guy with his leg up and his hands in these beautiful positions. And that's the moment of the end of the cycle and the beginning of the new cycle is when Shiva dances. So, excuse me, go ahead.
Abhinavagupta was a Shaivite, a devotee of Shiva. And for most Shaivites, Shiva is not just the destroyer. He is all three. He is creator, preserver, and destroyer at the same time. Matrika Shakti, Matrika is the actual dual strange power of language itself, deified as the female deity. And the dual power of language is its power to bind, is its power of illusion, as well as its power of liberation.
Right.
And so this is called Matrika Shakti, Word Mother. Mother of all sound, pregnant, expectant mother of all languages, diaphanous palimpsest, membrane origin of all unborn imaginings, enfolding out of its own absence, a state that precedes and yet provides the screen for the free and chaotic self-display of all permutations of memory, efflorescing in mellifluous eddies of duality and distinction, and fleeting sensual data having unfurled kaleidoscopic scenarios, self-generating from deep within you, uncreated womb space, pre-remembered dream states of unconsciousness, self-projecting its magic lantern of scintillating light upon antiquated prosceniums of plenum voids, theater of self-encapsulating permeable veils of self-definition and speculum-like self-reflection, enantiomorphically branching out like interior coral reefs of vascular passages of electrochemical hardware, biologically creating web-like structures for the fast exchange of information that are coated with poisonous, sticky, sweet bait, bristling with sensitive receptors disguised as flowing sensuous locks, soft wisps of suggestive body hair or prickly, bristly beards, all deceptively spring-loaded and decoyed with glistening gem-like reflections from their secret secretions that adhere, attach, ensnare, and digest their unwary victim admirers. It is you, O playful, deceptive mother, who transforms the undifferentiated bliss of universal consciousness into the never-ending babble of the ever-present chattering of the voiceless voices of language, self-speaking as uninterrupted internal cell phone calls, who disturbs the crystalline scintillating but not moving equilibrium of the unstruck sound with reverberating agitations of endless delicious diversities, struggling to grasp your ever-evaporating ungraspable webs of intricate formal structures and grammars, playfully murmuring both as outer dialogues and inner monologues, fading in and out of comprehension, addictively and obsessively leading us further and further down the vain and futile hope of ultimately arriving at understanding or ultimate satisfaction with using the enchantments and spells of your chimerical grammars, melting into smoke and mirror displays, never fully encapsulating nor delivering meaning, multiplying hydra-headed conceptual confusions and the feverish desire to free ourselves from your deliciously beautiful web of jewel-laden structure that becomes a noose in a sandpit of despair and desperation. You lead me towards a flaming addiction that I could never possibly assuage. Mother of language, you are a puta madre. Mother, you who equally dispense grace with your outstretched hand, opposite of the one that you use to dispense your illusions like a pusher who peddles crack to ignorant children. May I be blessed with an unmerited vision of your true nature, your encircling skulls displayed as alphabets known and unknown, never again tempting me towards outward projections or entanglements, but gnostically reverberating inwardly recollecting and collapsing back in on themselves in an uncreated splendors of your primeval origins, with a self-same smile of knowing wisdoms that no longer steal peace and freedom with distracting whisperings. Shanti, Shanti.
That's beautiful. Really vivid images there. Well, that sort of brings up two things for me. I mean, it brings up a lot of things, but in terms of discussion. One being that I love a lot of Western poetry, but I find that a lot of Western poets are largely ignorant and sort of don't care about this vast reservoir of Eastern poetry, and specifically spiritual Eastern poetry. And so when they hear a poem like that, it seems to be coming from way out in left field. And I find it really wonderful the way you've taken this ancient tradition and sort of brought it right into Western mind with, like, crack and various things like that. And the other, I'll throw in real quick, too, is one thing that Gigi talks about a lot and I find refreshing about this poem is that I think a lot of gay men nowadays have a real almost phobia of their own female energy. I mean, not everybody, but I mean, it has to be expressed in a very macho way somehow.
Well, I don't mean to be negative, but I just want to bring up some things and sort of bounce it.
And anyway, that has such a beautiful appreciation of just embracing all of the complexity of female energy within oneself or whatever.
Well, I was trained as a pujari for a Vedanta center.
Mm-hmm. And what is that?
Well, this has to do with Ramakrishna, who was a saint in 19th century India. And I sort of stumbled upon, there's several Vedanta centers in Houston, but Ramakrishna is actually considered sort of a saint in contemporary Hinduism.
Mm-hmm.
But he was actually heretically, maybe heretically, but hereditarily, he was hereditarily a Kali priest in Calcutta at turn of the century. And when the British, when India was first becoming very westernized, and Christopher Isherwood, another tie-in here,
right, yeah,
became obsessed, and when he moved to the United States, was a big member of the Vedanta Society in Los Angeles, and one of his sadhanas, our practices, he was told to translate the gospel or the biography of Ramakrishna into English.
Ooh.
And so that remains a very inspiring text. But this person, Ramakrishna, who was wild, and there's been some recent books that are very controversial in India that sort of bring up a lot of homoerotic questions in Ramakrishna's life,
mm-hmm,
because of his attraction to these.
And I find that more current biographies of different poets and spiritual leaders and in general, that there is a greater honesty and more information about the details of their lives without so much shame and we can't let people know this or that or whatever. And I find that really helpful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He was a very wild individual who actually became possessed by the goddess and had all of these visions that all of the different spiritual traditions in the world were all actually manifestations of her.
Right. So you were talking about how you were trained in a particular thing.
Well, that was, you know, to do the rituals, and it was a very wonderful experience. But he actually is connected in many ways with sort of, he's an example of this sort of gay shaman individual.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, I had heard that. I don't know too much about him, but I had kind of, I seem to remember running across that.
Yeah. And we actually attended a workshop together with Andrew Harvey.
Right, which was wonderful.
And I know that he's still active today, but that's a very interesting strain that seems to be sanitized from today's gay scene.
Right.
And yet, to me, poetry is a part of that, is a part of the wildness, the insanity, the mystic vision. And I, you know, ask myself.
Well, and one thing I'll throw in here, too, is one thing I find refreshing about the ecstatic nature of the poem is that a lot of times in purely Western mindset and Western writing and, you know, modern poets, especially kids that I'll run across at poetry readings, that the wildness only comes through in kind of a dead-end way or in a complaint way. It's this wild whining and thrashing and complaining in a container they can't find a way out of, and a frustration and an anger. And with very little transcendence, and they don't really seem to find a path to the ecstatic side of it. You know, even Blakeyan ecstatic side, or you know, Rambodian. You know, it's.
I don't know what to say about that, but I'm always sort of, you know.
I think this is. This leads to something like that in the melding between the two.
I'm always interested in trying to push language to its barriers. For me, poetry, when I engage in it, I do a lot of other fiction writing, but for me, poetry is a sphere of really pushing things. And many years ago, I've almost read almost everything that Gertrude Stein has ever written. That was a very early, deep
She's
influence.
Amazing, yeah.
And I agree with her and her perception of the notion of the outworn vehicle. The outworn, and of the real discipline of really aiming at trying to have a form that cuts through directly to what you're really aiming at.
Right. Well, I've been thinking a lot this week in particular about how a lot of general behavior, and I find it in poetry specifically, that even in my own work, a lot of stuff has to do with constantly defining yourself as kind of a protection and kind of a security blanket. And the whole idea that if we try to really cut through, like you're saying, to the source of something and really forget about defining ourselves, that we're quite recognizable, you know, if we don't define ourselves at all, there's something essentially about our karma, who we are, that is absolutely recognizable. And that might be also why people are afraid to do that, because they don't want to be recognized. They're afraid of being known, especially in an ecstatic way.
Well, also, I can't help from thinking also about Buddha Dharma, too. And about that whole aspect and that influence that has a very strong awareness of identity.
Right.
And of its traps.
Right.
Of the trap of identity, whatever it is. And
separation.
And the freedom that it sort of allows you, and that's the whole Naropa school of poetics. And even Trungpa, that's what is also very inspiring to me. And it comes out in your own work, too, very, very strongly. And there's a space, there is an experimentation that people who are not connected with that kind of discipline maybe are not, they catch themselves up in their own traps sooner or later.
But I try to also use understandable language. Sometimes I just go for it, and I admire and I love that kind of stuff. But sometimes I try to, you know, okay, here's all these like really big thought forms, these really esoteric ideas. How do you put it in plain language so it's a gift in a sense? Well, time's rolling on. Why don't you read another poem?
Okay.
I mean, I find all your ideas fascinating, but I also want to hear more poetry.
This is actually based on, there's a couple. This is a short one. It reminded me of, I was attempting to capture Ginsberg's sort of musical metaphor. And this is, there is a rag which in Indian music is based all about suggestion. It's a very indirect way to structure a musical piece. And this is kind of a collision between contemporary car-oriented with a very wild, it's kind of macabre, but there's the Rag Bhairav, which is played in India in twilight and at dawn when they believe that nature itself is at its most unstable. Roadside Rag Bhairav, almost as if dumbstruck with the sight of a decapitated head lying on the side of the road from a car accident, its eyes remaining obscenely open, the full moon shining, gleaming its light in the misplaced location of the dawn sky, reeling amnesiacally in its fullness of lost time, of morning that remains deepest night, caught unaware, the naked reveler in the headlights of dawn, exuding a deep, crepuscular, menacing shade, blushed at its own brazen display. The droning, mumbling morning news mentioned blocked traffic due to a head-on collision with an epiphany that must have occurred early this morning. An unrecognized, unpurchasable, unrealized source of pleasure backed up traffic for miles this morning. The streetlights flickered in ecstasy, moonstruck, drunk on the nectar of nights without end, causing them to abandon identification with the mirror shell structures of their bodies.
Wow. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. You know what, actually, I just got through reading a biography of Jim Morrison. And if he had been a bit more sophisticated, a lot more sophisticated, there's something very Morrison about that. And actually, in the book, again, the biography is much more honest, you know, 30 years later. And they do have a scene where he, early on in his fame, when he met Ginsberg, and Ginsberg just thought he was wonderful and flirted with him and made it really clear that he was welcome into his bed. And Jim said, thanks, but no thanks. But in fact, they do talk a lot about Jim Morrison's bisexuality and his adventures in the gay underground in L.A. during that time, which hasn't been acknowledged heretofore. But that poem is... I like the idea, you know, the inference you were talking about, because it's so direct and yet it's not, you know, it's so oblique.
Well, I've had sort of inspiration as
it's
a performance.
It's oblique but penetrating, you know.
Well, I appreciate that coming from you. I try to kind of I'm really inspired, as I was a performance artist, the way that I would construct a performance is very indirectly. It's very sort of just circumambulating around the subject, and it's very imagistic.
Right.
And to me, in many ways, poetry is another sphere playing with a lot of experimental. But I want to throw out the notion that the generation today, it seems, I don't know if you feel this or sense it, it seems that there's a shying away from any complexity.
Right. Oh, definitely. Definitely. There's massive information, but it doesn't seem to be about complexity. It just seems to be about intake.
Yeah. It's interesting, and you know, I give a couple of lectures on the side at school and the creative writing program and on Japanese aesthetics. And
well, and I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's very interesting.
The whole idea that complexity is still very simple.
Mm-hmm.
That it's made up of simple things. You know, in fact, complexity allows things to be more simple in some sense. I mean, in terms of when you look at all the details and all the aspects of and as you complexity reveals itself, it's actually all these simple facets sort of, you know, gleaming.
I hope I'm wrong, but I really get a sense that the mystical hunger is not there for this generation.
I don't think it. Well, you know, I'm a Buddhist, so I think everybody has Buddha nature, and I don't think it's really gone. I think, like I said, it's a dark age. A lot of things are very, very thick and hard to see. It's hard to see things right now.
But the things that empowered or that propelled a lot of people, a lot of our brothers and sisters and the other generations, it just the depths, wanting to plunge the depths, it doesn't.
I think there are some.
I want to be disproved.
I think it's sort of, in a way, back to the 50s.
Uh-huh.
In the sense of that they're out there, they're doing it, but they're in the minority again.
Mm.
For a while, it seemed like it was the majority.
Mm.
And then that pendulum swung back.
But it's an interesting sort of observation. Music, poetry seems to be expressed a lot more in contemporary music.
Right. I want to throw one more thing out, again, from the Morrison biography, is, you know, you're talking about the indirectness.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I was talking to my brother about was how one thing I don't think Morrison has been acknowledged for is the fact that he was the first person to get up and hold an audience, you know, right there, hold their attention, and do poetry in sort of, they would have these song structures, the popular songs, and it'd be like Light Your Fire is a big hit, and he got bored with it. Well, they'd vamp, and they'd do these long periods, and he'd do these long poems in concert, and they were often not direct. It'd be like, what the hell is he talking about? And that indirectness you were talking about, and the relationship to Morrison I saw in that poem, and again, I think it's only now that it's barely being that, you know, that inspiration, that line of inspiration is maybe starting to be picked up.
In the Indian tradition, indirectness is sort of, in poetry, is supposedly the cause of the pleasure of poetry.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is.
They have
this
word.
Wow, I never thought of that.
That it is, Davani translates as resonance, or it also suggestion that you create some sort of resonance. You allow maybe the implications are that you allow some sort of space for this flavor or this taste to come over.
Yeah, I mean, it's the only way you can say it. I mean, that's the reason, I think, in a way, because, you know, there's nothing necessarily really poetic about, you know,
give me a glass of milk. You know, if you're talking to your mother, you know, whereas if it's a whole...
And the interesting thing is that in the Indian tradition, the aim is not didactic. The aim of theater, of poetry, is not... we have all these Western Aristotelian, you know, you're supposed to learn some lesson. For them,
right.
It's pure pleasure.
Right.
And what was odd about the Natya...
Well, and knowledge is pleasure.
Yes.
Knowledge is pleasure.
Yeah.
It's not a means to an end, and yet there is fruition.
There is a yogic implication, especially in the Natya Shastra, that it's sort of like their Noah's Ark story, that instead of creating a flood to kill everyone who were wayward, they created drama. And thus, they sort of... That is the unique twist on that
story. So that's where drama queens came from.
But the implication is that it sort of, in a pleasurable way, accomplishes the traditional yogic aims of detaching people from their normal... obsession,
so that there can be some sort of objective overview,
and they get caught up in the drama
and sort of intoxicated,
and they lose their self obsessions for a while.
And I think that also that whole thing of when very much the tradition of, like, when somebody listens, somebody who's closeted out in somewhere listens to this show and goes, oh, I'm not the only gay person, all of a sudden they're not alone. So, I mean, that whole idea of when they get lost in the drama, they see that their experience is a human experience.
Exactly.
That they're it's all completely connected.
And they point, they suggest one of the most sort of emphasized humanitarian goals of poetry and literature, and that's empathy.
Right. Absolutely.
And it really causes the compassionate element to really blossom, to really sort of loosen your own hold and identify with people and situations that you wouldn't normally do so.
So, I mean, just an off-the-wall question. Where is humor in all that? And where does... Is there humor in the tradition?
There is extreme amount of humor. Of course, humorous is one of the 9 recognized flavors of drama, and it's given on the same dignity as all of the rest that include horror and disgust. But actually, there's a reference, and I don't know, I haven't heard too much about it, but... Shuntar Vishuvalingam. He is the scholar that is now making all of his work. He's an incredibly generous scholar, and this is an example of one of the wonderful aspects of the internet. And he's making all of his doctoral thesis and dissertations available for comment and for public distribution on the website. Is it okay to say?
Sure, absolutely.
Is www.svabhinava.org. www.svabhinava.org. And he makes this study and this emphasis and controversies with Western subjects available. And he brings out what he calls a transgressive sacrality.
Oh, I like that.
I mean,
that's very connected to my work, the whole idea that in some sense in modern society, to really emphasize the sacred is to be transgressive.
It is.
Is to cut through all the categorization of vulgar and sublime and all of that.
And that connects to humor. I remember a quote.
I loved Andrew Hardy and Harvey and a lot of what he did. But I also felt he had this sort of English sort of
uptight
fear of the vulgar.
Yeah.
You know, which was a limitation as far as I was concerned.
Yeah, I can see that.
Anyway.
There's some quote with Abhimagupta, this philosopher, that saying that humor is the base ground for all of the emotions, the emotional development.
Right.
And that is connected in reference to some of Shuntar's more sort of radical articles that he proposed. Mm-hmm. And
it's like the thing of, like, seriousness doesn't make sense without humor, and humor doesn't make sense without seriousness.
And his wife is another recognized scholar who's studied in Benares and in India, and she became obsessed with the sort of demonic manifestation of Shiva called Bhairava.
Ooh.
That is just very complex, and he's all over India, all over Nepal, and there are connections with
And this is in the website you're talking about.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, her work is available as well. Mm-hmm. And he's just a wild man. If anything, he's very, very much almost the same deity as Kalachakra, or even more Mahakala.
Mm-hmm. And I think those deity forms, those deity energies are particularly relevant in trying to get your mind around what's happening in the world today. You know, in terms of how much, you know, craziness has to be embraced, and not,
well,
or how do you find the thread of sanity in all the insane? How do you look directly at all the insanity that's going on and transform it as you go along into some sort of sanity as you walk your path?
Well, Shuntara has a new article actually about madness, insanity in the West as opposed to India, that has a long tradition even today of revering. It's just completely
and
crazy.
And madness, and madness is a great, great, long-term poetic tradition.
Oh.
In whatever nation, whatever era.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
The madness of love or whatever, you know?
And it was a very interesting article on his website about looking at madness itself as a spiritual state and
mm-hmm.
contrasting it to Western institutions of psychiatry, and how Michel Foucault
mm-hmm.
sort of a lot of his work talked about the Western attempts at sort of sequestering or pushing off
right.
to the fringes of Western society madness, and
mm-hmm.
just sort of this feudal attempt. But
read another poem.
Okay.
Because we've been going on and on and on. I mean, it's great stuff, you know, but I also love hearing
poems. I think you've heard this poem.
Well, I'm sure it'll...
This is very strange.
No, not one of your poems.
And it's definitely the erotic flavor. And there is the tantric notion that every sensual perception is essentially a sexual act.
So Gigi would love this poem.
Oh, yeah. And this is about a tantric ritual that is based upon or inspired just by a perception. And it was a tracing back an erotic gaze. There is a tantric ritual of the gaze to...
Oh, that's a nice little pun there, too. Pardon me for throwing that in, but I couldn't help it.
And it's called Clerk Ani Charyana. The cosmic man and the man in the left eye. Was I pierced and suspended, dangling from his mellifluous lashes, enshrouding atramentous apertures, convex in lapidities, that becomes concave as they dig out the contents of my deepest interior regions, breathing in unison, there is an exchange, a layering and a seepage, a consummation of membranes of perception magnetized by the coitus of the boy's face, with the maturity and the developments of a man's body in his lanky frame, as his unwashed and well-worn jeans precariously suspend from the lithe, warm cradle of his pelvic girdle, a ladder that draws one closer, aching to climb, a shallow grave of hidden, unacknowledged lusts of pleasures, breathing in unison, exchanging heat and sense. From subterranean fissures, masculine and feminine feed on each other as their fluids commingle and become admixtured in the fixities of gaze clamped down upon you, feeding off the energy of physical attractions, a smoldering erotics of manipulation, and a voyeurism of watching someone else stung by the irradiating lusts of your own inner narcissisms, masculine commingling with feminine, realizing their inescapabilities without denigration, disowning our projection. I embrace you by becoming you, wrapping my DNA coils around yours inversely, until I embrace your spinal column, the great phallus of mystery, and lay my head in your pelvic bone, coming out the other side, gazing out at myself, attempting to magnetize my attention, looking down at your body, an admixture of young becoming old, masculine becoming feminine, circulating between its own polarities of desire, observed from deep within and behind your own eye sockets, observing how your preternatural voice, deep with a resonance and muskiness, arises from behind your navel, inverting my consciousness, becomes a loincloth whose membranes are pierced and co-penetrated multiple times in unison to our magnetized breaths. Looking out from behind your own eyes, offered in sacrifice in the beginning of the world, into the mouth of fire.
Wow. Wow, that's beautiful. Yeah, that's that. Yep. Been there, done that. Very wonderful. Very wonderful. What's that little short one right next to it?
This is almost purely abstract.
Cool.
And some of my plays, I'm very interested in plays with words, very interested in the color or texture of words themselves, and just what do they cause you to, where do they cause you to go?
Well, I have this idea that there are certain things that cannot be expressed. So you write something that evokes a feeling or points in that direction or puts you in that space because it's not something you could talk about. So, again, you can only get there by suggestion, by the inference. And sometimes it will be by saying something that really doesn't make sense, almost. And sometimes literally doesn't make sense, but it somehow takes you to a place where you know something.
Yeah, part of the theory of, you know, they sort of belabored
over that. And that's, for folks out there, that's one of the things about poetry. When you're reading something and it's not making sense and you struggle with poetry, just relax. Mm. It's probably not supposed to make sense. Just kind of go with how it makes you feel or where it takes you.
I would feel a success if people even felt a very subtle something, a very abstract or subtle, I would still feel that that's a successful
right.
reading
right.
to me. This is called Unspoken Eulogy. Catafalques before an interactive interior architectronics of rediscovered memory. Interruptions spilling underground without a car, by scent to an edifice, scenting the tenebrosities collected from centrifugalities of passers-by, of rain and temporalities, handied feet plus the suspension of thresholds, sitting into the bones or hovering suspended in reverse, the crumbling display of the public sector, paper-bound volumes in painted covers, drifting, drawn in Oppidian precipitations, intersecting wet, running blacknesses.
Wow. That's like a bridge. That's like walking on a bridge from someplace to someplace.
Actually, I maybe felt sort of a September 11th in this, and I think that this was written around that time period.
Sure, sure. Well, and that was going from, you know, one era to another, you know, regardless of how you felt about what shape that should take. But, I mean, it was definitely a change in
It was
consciousness.
Definitely. It was very metaphorical. It was very archetypal. What about some of yours? What about some more of your poetry?
Well, we got a little bit of time left. I actually did come across one that yours suggested to me, and all the subject. And this is just, I've written a lot of hardcore pornographic poems, or a portion of them. And I hadn't written one in a long time, and actually I recently wrote some, but there was a long period where they just didn't come up, and what was coming out was more stuff like this, so here's one. Two boys, snake entwined, so impossibly beautiful together, it makes them sad. Rolling over and over each other across the desert floor, as though it still was the lush forest long gone, where once flourished their intertwining body parts composing an iconoclastic display of an impermanence that never lies but still changes instantly over and over each moment. Theirs is the thrust and release of exuberance as it explores every nook and cranny of emptiness that shines with bliss beyond conception within each nuance, each manifestation on any level, with and without, before and for each other, as it is revealed, tracing and retracing over and over each displacement until it completes its transparency in the natural precision of their mutually receptive response as they writhe against and into each other. How boring to be afraid. So they find the clarity and magic, the realistic faith and radical trust to transform every obstacle into an interesting interaction, humbled through extreme sensitivity that will go through anything to get to a childlike wonder with which to invest in a timeless, nourishing, heartfelt wisdom. This must happen whether it happens or not. How astounding that humans find a way to love, to give love, to share love over and over each time.
It's great, and it was beautifully written typographically, too.
Yeah, I have this whole, I try to write them on the poem, how they read, on the page, how they read.
Slithering on the page.
Yeah.
What do you think about, I just came across a quote in the Chronicle for Higher Education, someone, just a comment that poetry is dead.
Ha!
What,
Ha, I say.
It was an odd statement.
Well, if anything is going to kill it, it's its popularity right now. I mean, there's so many poetry readings, and there's a lot of poetry been being written by people who are definitely not poets, and I say that from extremely snobby point of view, and I also encourage everybody to write whether they're a poet or not. So I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm elitist, but I'm not.
But I think that more than ever, people are finding out that poetry is a way to get to know themselves, and a way to become friends of with themselves. And it's a very private thing that can also lead to a sort of public sharing. And I think that a lot of young people are very comfortable with poetry in a way that they haven't ever been before, partially because of rap. Actually, another Jim Morrison thing, they asked him about the future of music years ago. When he was alive. And he said, oh, in the future, what I see is one person with a lot of electronic machines that will be invented doing a kind of poetic thing with a lot of self-created music. So he basically predicted what's happening now. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's far from dead. What do you think?
It's interesting. I just...
Now, granted, there's a lot of sophistication that needs to come into it, I think.
For the appearance of a comment like that, very conspicuously, to me, says something. Something is up. But at the same time, I worry, because poetry was so much in the past connected with passion, mm-hmm. with sort of a radicalism, mm-hmm. and sort of a radical vision, and just my own sort of suspicion of the conspicuousness of its absence today.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't quite see...
Well, how do you see its absence? Maybe I'm just looking for it, so I see it around. But
I want to be disproved.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be disproved. I just see a conspicuous absence of, for lack of a better word, idealism.
Okay.
Of a sense.
Right. Right. No, I struggle with that myself too, in terms of. The old fart kind of questioning why these kids are writing this stuff and why aren't you going here and why aren't you going there. And at the same time, trusting that they'll mature and they'll develop, maybe, as they go along.
But it was an interesting comment. And, supposedly Rumi, the Persian Turkish poet of the first millennium,
mm-hmm.
approximately, is currently the best-selling poet.
Yeah.
And Coleman Barks, sort of his translation of Rumi, which are great in their own way, but they sanitize the essential heretical
nature.
They
do and they don't.
Mm.
Because ecstasy is always, subversive.
Yeah.
And he and Robert Bly came and read in the Brown and Root a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. at the Alley. And they did the first half of their poetry, and the second half was just their translations of
mm-hmm.
Rumi.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with you about the sanitization, but at the same time, they made what was left of Rumi, mm-hmm. in their translations unified the room into one heart, one mind, one spirit.
Mm-hmm.
I have never seen a crowd walk out of a poetry reading so intoxicated.
Oh, well, that's great.
It was lovely. So, it comes through, even though if it's not in its strongest potency,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
okay, we're getting the sign to wrap up. Have you got a short poem to?
Well, this is
It would have to be very short.
Yeah, this is.
Okay,
quickly,
because we're getting very close to the end.
And this is someone who I just knew just briefly, who passed away at school. Before the movements of the month stopped by, the recognition of an absence that suddenly stained the silhouette of your presence and memory, a suspended shadow opaque with permanence that surpasses human understanding or identity, an unwelcome intrusion into the quotidian, excluded and excised from the daily world by futile shows of communal ritual. Your unbidden rupture of the finite stains the remembered image of your reading into a photographic shadow that calculates and recites poems and algebraic equations of infinity, the dance of the earthly exponents and factors, and the play of the yin-yang of your time-bound equations may have come to rest, only to enlarge the spheres of calculation resonating from a timeless algebraic formula where X is equal to the infinity of all its properties and Y is equal and greater than the spaces of absence that occupies our memories, still at play, internally dancing silhouettes, alive, ever present in the peripheries and beloved hidden spaces of solitude of our minds and hearts.
Very beautiful. And definitely, poetry has always been a way of remembering whatever it is we need to remember, people, places, ideas. Well, thank you so much for being my guest. You have made it so easy to come back on the air with your wealth of information that I'm sure a lot of people had no idea of, and it informed me, and I'm sure it informed whoever was listening. So thanks a lot, Paul, for coming in.
Oh, well, thank you.
It's Paul Smith. If you see his name anywhere, it's going to be good stuff. So thanks to Jimmy and Chris for having me, as usual. And so what's up, Chris?
Well, we're just going to be wrapping up here. We're going to play a little music to get us out, and then the traditional PSAs at the end of the show. This has been After Hours Queer Radio with Attitude on listener sponsored, commercial free.
Okay, so thanks and good night. And if you are not a poet and you're feeling something you need to express, don't be afraid to write it down and share it with somebody. Hey, good night.
If you want to share it with us, you can send us an email at afterhours@kpft.org. Right. We're going to go a little classic. Our show discovered this artist, and we're going to be playing her again. It's Sarah Golden, and the song is I Love You More Than Jell-O.
Yeah,
you know, first of all, I don't like Jell-O.
I love Jell-O.
I don't like anything that wiggles more than I do.
Oh, gee, then there's so much you would hate.
Click. And plus, Jell-O's only good when you've got alcohol in it. So we're going to play a little Sarah, and then the PSAs, and then after that, at the top of the hour, it's the Mr. Schmidt World Happy Domination Hour.
World Happy Domination?
Did I get it mixed up?
Close enough.
Hey, it's 4 o'clock in the morning. If you want picture perfect, then, you know.
Yeah, well, we ain't it.
This is At Mid After Hours on KPFT Houston.
In my heart, and you'll always be my girl. I end up.
Join the Pacifica Radio Archives for our fifth annual national broadcast on all five Pacifica stations. Voices for Peace and Nonviolence.
It's not enough to do demonstrations against the war and then go home. There must be something else.
On Tuesday, November 28th and Wednesday, November 29th, the Pacifica Radio Archives will be broadcasting treasures from our historic collection. We will also be premiering The Ballad of Pete Seeger, celebrating the life and times of America's legendary folk balladeer, featuring a candid conversation with Tim Robbins and historic audio from the archives.
There is an infinite pool of good faith just waiting for humankind to drink from.
That's November 28th and 29th. The Pacifica Radio Archives presents Voices for Peace and Nonviolence, simulcast on all five Pacifica stations. For a complete broadcast schedule or to find out how you can help preserve the over 50,000 tapes in the archives, please visit www.supportpra.org.
Nothing lasts forever.
Baby can't stop crying. She needed more than a little love to see her through.
Half a million babies are born too soon.
The sun just can't keep shining. Cause it's much too late. Baby's gone for good.
And for so many, too soon means too.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.